I'm Tori Maguire, and this is Please Explain.
ISIS continues to lose ground in Syria.
In its dying days, ISIS fights to the bitter end.
We have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land.
It's the ultimate dilemma for Australian authorities. What to do with the children of Australian Islamic State members holed up in a putrid camp in northern Syria after the fall of the so-called caliphate? Firstly, how would we get them out?
I really want my kids just to be in a safe place. I don't want them to be in these camps where there's nothing around us.
Secondly, what will we do with them once they've made it to Australia?
The main thing I worry about is it's going to follow him everywhere his whole life. He's a sweet, sweet boy.
Whose problem are the cubs of the caliphate?
And if anything happens to them, it's going to be a very dark day on Australia's history.
Hello and welcome to Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. I'm delighted to have David Rowe, Defence and National Security Correspondent for the SMH and The Age, and Kate Geraghty, Veteran Photojournalist for The Herald, here on the podcast this week. These two have just returned from 2 weeks in Iraq and Syria. Welcome home to both of you.
Thank you.
And later on, I'll ask ANU's de-radicalisation expert, Dr. Clark Jones, just how do you reintegrate children from extreme groups and cults? But first, we've heard so much about Syria over the past few years. For most people, the cities and territories in this country sound like strange, foreign places, and horrific acts of violence and depravity have come out of them. You've actually been there in the last week. Kate, what's it like?
Well, the areas that we travelled through predominantly were Kurdish-held areas, so we didn't really see a lot of destruction because this area had been heavily defended by the Syrian democratic forces. However, in our whole camp, the situation is quite dire. We also went down to Omar Airfield, which is probably the closest staging point towards Baghouz, but we could not get access to that area because there were still coalition airstrikes going on. But in general, Syria and Iraq, we've travelled there many times over the years, and the people, their hospitality is, to be honest, it's overwhelming. They're very kind people, and they've gone through unimaginable horrors.
So does normal life just go on? I mean, are people running businesses and sending their kids to school and trading with each other?
Yes, I would say life does go on. Especially like if we look back at Mosul, while the East had been liberated and the West battle was still continuing, already businesses were starting to flourish. In Syria, on this particular trip, you would see, even in the camps, women and children with trolleys, with small food products that they were selling. So I think it's a natural human instinct to start back up as soon as you can.
David, how hard is it to get around?
Look, you have to be really careful. So, for instance, in Qamishli, the city in the north in the Kurdish-held area of Syria where we were staying, we could literally turn left out of our hotel front door, but not right. If we had turned right, we would have run into a Syrian regime checkpoint and thereby risked being arrested and whisked away to Damascus for detention and questioning. There are literally sort of streets and blocks that you have to be careful around. If you move by vehicle, you have to be really careful, which towns you go through and which towns you stop in. In fact, you can't stop in a lot of places. If you go south from Qamishli down towards the Euphrates Valley and down towards Baghouz, which was the village on the river where IS made its final stand against the Kurdish forces, those are Sunni Arab villages down that way, they are still very IS sympathetic. They see that as their land, and they see the Kurdish forces, which are essentially occupying those villages, they have checkpoints and they have soldiers stationed there, they see those as an occupying force. So there is still a lot of tension. As Kate says, life does go on for the local people in these villages, but as a foreigner in particular, you will attract some interest pretty quickly if you spend any significant amount of time there. So basically, you have a local driver and a local fixer sitting in the front of your vehicle. You sit in the back in the dark, preferably with the curtains drawn, and you keep a low profile and you just keep driving.
I didn't find it scary. I think that we take every precaution that we can. We have been to these places before, so, you know, wearing a hijab and having the curtains drawn.
You wore a hijab?
Yeah,
I did. The whole time you were there?
Well, no, only on the drive through through these particular villages that were were sympathetic to the Islamic State.
I agree. I mean, I never felt exactly threatened or at risk. I mean, you of course are keep a very wary eye out. You have to be cautious. You have people with you who are giving you sound advice on things to look out for. So really, it is a sort of risk management issue. You don't do stupid things, and you sort of stay focused on what you have to do and don't expose yourself to any more risk than you have to. You certainly don't go around moving around areas where there might be IEDs, for instance. Everywhere where you travel, you need to make sure that someone has been through there before, somebody like a Kurdish soldiers, for instance, and done the mine clearing. Otherwise, you know, everyone knows that IS have festooned every town and village that they have occupied with booby trap bombs or improvised explosive devices, IEDs as they're called, really to take out anyone who comes after them. So that is really the predominant threat to journalists. And there was sadly an NBC local driver killed in Baghouz shortly before we arrived down in that part of Syria. He had opened a door of a house, and it was rigged up with an explosive, and sadly he died.
Gosh. So you went there for a couple of reasons, one of which we will get to soon and examine in depth, but the first one being that you really went to cover the end of ISIS. I mean, Islamic State has captured the imaginations of Australians in the most horrifying way for the last 5 or so years, where we have watched this sort of, you know, the kind of cinematic violence that they have wrought upon this part of the world. Is it actually dead? Is Islamic State dead?
No, it's not dead. The ideology behind it certainly still exists. And as I mentioned before, some of those Sunni Arab towns and villages that currently hold a grievance against the Kurdish forces that are there, their most unifying view is one of Sunni extreme. The Sunni extremists can actually unify those people by using their ideology as a kind of a driving force against outsiders. So that, you know, I think there's real potential there for those people to continue with an IS ideology. The same is true in Iraq. Sunnis in Iraq, if you look at what happened after the Americans left Iraq in 2011, I think it was really the excesses of the Shiite government of al-Maliki in Baghdad that created the resentment among Sunnis caused, you know, them to turn from an al-Qaeda group into and sort of morph into Islamic State. So it's really easy for Sunni Arabs in that part of the world to rally around that kind of ideology. And until the geopolitics are better managed, including by the West, then that is always going to be a risk.
Kate, are there any sort of visual signs of the end of Islamic State? I mean, is there still visual evidence of their existence?
The only remnants that we saw of the the former caliphate of the Islamic State was an arch over a road between Qamishli and Hasaka that had, you know, the Arabic writing saying basically, you know, that you're in the caliphate. The other thing regarding the end of the caliphate, well, it still continues. ISIS tried to break out of a prison in Derik just in the last 4 to 5 days. And in the last 24 to 48 hours, there's been attacks in Deir ez-Zor. So, you know, the population, the civilian population are confronting sleeper cells, same with foreign journalists and the Kurdish forces there. So I think it will still continue.
And there are, yeah, I'd add, I mean, there are routine and, in fact, daily attacks on the Kurdish forces in those towns and villages around the Deir ez-Zor province and along the Euphrates Valley where those Sunni populations are.
So the other reason that you went there was that the Australian government now have this extraordinary dilemma because quite a number of Australian citizens went off to join Islamic State. Many of them married, many of them had children, some of them took children with them, some of them had children while they were there. Most of them are now dead, but their wives and children are alive and they are living in the Al-Hol camp in northern Syria, and we now have to work out what to do with them because they want to come to Australia, which is entirely understandable because they're living in squalor in northern Syria. You spoke to quite a number of Australian families in limbo. David, we're just going to listen to a bit of audio from a video you filmed in the camp during a conversation with Shema Assad, who is the wife of a Sydney tradesman, Mohammed Noor Masri, who you found earlier in that week in jail.
No.
What do you say to people who argue that you joined a terrible organisation and in doing so you betrayed your own country and therefore don't deserve to be Australian again?
I think the same way they'd have wanted a second chance, they should give other people a second chance. Everyone in life deserves a second chance. So why can't we have a second chance? We're human just the same way they're human and everybody makes mistakes.
David, tell us about who this woman is and her situation. Where did you speak to her?
So I spoke to her in Al-Hol camp. She is there with her three sons who she's had with Mohammed Noor Masri. She is pregnant with a fourth child who she says is a daughter.
And how old is she?
She is 19 years old. She was 15 when she went over there. She was taken over there by her parents. Now, her parents, the family's account is that Shema's two brothers had already gone over to Syria to join IS, and the family went looking for them. Now, interestingly enough, Shema, her mother is actually there with her in the camp as well. Her father has gone elsewhere. He's in a detention facility somewhere else. They don't know where, but a detention facility for men. And my obvious question to Shema's mother was, well, if you and your husband decided you had to come and look for your sons, why on earth did you bring your 15-year-old daughter with you? Now, I mean, her answer was they didn't want to split the family up. But, I mean, you have to wonder about those sorts of questions when you consider the plausibility of what the family is saying. I mean, if they weren't joining IS and they were just looking for the sons, then, you know, what on earth were they thinking bringing their 15-year-old daughter? She did marry Mohammed fairly soon after she arrived. So she was a 15-year-old bride, started having children. She gives an almost word for word account, the same account word for word as her husband, Mohammed, as to what their situation was. They got there. They didn't realize what they were getting themselves into. They wanted to leave, but it was difficult to escape. They talked to people smugglers. They dealt with people smugglers, but either got ripped off or let down. It was just too difficult to get out. So they kept their heads down, tried to stay at home. They sort of bounced. Once Al-Raqqa, the IS capital, was retaken by the Kurds, they sort of bounced their way down the Euphrates Valley along with the rest of the remnants of IS until they they wound up in Baghouz, and during the battle there there was one of the pauses in fighting so that people could surrender, and they took that opportunity to surrender and then were in Kurdish custody. So that's how Shema ended up in Al-Hol camp.
No one would think that it was a good decision of her parents to take her there, and that those parents should be made to face the consequences of that. But it must be interesting, David, to look at a young woman who's 19 years old. She didn't choose to go there. It wasn't her adult decision. She now has three young children who didn't choose to be born there. It's quite a dilemma, isn't it? Because bringing them home will be a logistical challenge in itself, and there's a moral challenge in it as well. But how do you see her plight?
I regard her and the Sharif children essentially as abused kids. They were taken into a war zone by their parents. They have been given over for marriage at very young ages, presumably, well, if not against their will, then certainly not with their informed consent. Zainab Sharif, the eldest surviving Sharif daughter, was given to her terrorist father, Khalid Sharif's friend and fellow terrorist, Mohammed Elamar, for marriage at the age of 13 years old. I consider these to be comparable to abused children, and I can't think of another circumstance in which the Australian government would say, we are going to look the other way or abandon Australian citizens who are abused children simply because it is too difficult to do anything about them. Yes, the challenges are there, but they're not insurmountable. The Kurds have made it very clear that they are happy to facilitate a handover if the Australian government is prepared. It's been done in the case of some French children. You know, so it is doable. In terms of the risk, and I've been reading pieces in some newspapers over the last couple of days about the risk that these children would pose if they came back to Australia and grew up. Obviously, they've seen terrible things. They've experienced terrible things. They probably have been indoctrinated to an IS ideology to some extent. They have been radicalised. But guess what? We're an advanced country. We have a proper medical and welfare system. We have psychologists. We have psychiatrists. We have social workers. These are still kids. And I don't see any reason why we can't unindoctrinate them and de-radicalise them in a wealthy, advanced country. They're Australian citizens. I mean, I just think that once you strip away the sort of horror that we have, that has grown around IS, and I think has tainted our ability to look at this rationally, we would say that these are Aussie kids who are facing a serious plight, and it's not unreasonable to do something about them.
Kate, can you give us a bit of a tour of the camp? What are the conditions like? What are these people living in?
So when you first turn up to the camp, there are checkpoints. You have to show your permits. You are then immediately confronted with a long road that is dirt. It's raining. There are people milling around in amongst the Kurdish soldiers. Then you walk to the left, down another short distance, and there are gates and a fence. At this point, there are more security guards. You then go through that, show your permits. You're also escorted by Syrian they were the YPJ female soldiers. And then straight away there is an inner square in this camp, and that is where a predominant amount of the IS families are. There were several women and children up against that fence line. They had shopping lists in their hands. They were yelling out to us. They wanted to go to the shops. They were saying that their children are ill in the camp, in the tents. Then there is feces everywhere on the side of the fence line. It's muddy. We would see people cooking on fires outside the tents. Also, you could hear gas bottles inside the tents, which are also very, very dangerous for people inside. You would see people, like I was talking about before, you know, pushing carts with the little bits of food that they could get together to sell. Women hanging washing over the fence line. There were children playing. And, I mean, it's got 73,000 people in it. It's a city basically without too much order. There are a limited amount of international NGOs in there. And, yeah, I certainly
it
would
not. It
sounds
like hell on earth, to be honest.
I've seen a lot of refugee camps around the world, and this would be right up there with one of the worst. Mm. Yeah.
So while you guys were over there doing this reporting, we had people back here trying to talk to families. You found another Australian woman in that camp, David, a woman called Kirsty. And back here, one of our reporters in Melbourne spoke to her mother.
If I had the money, I'd fly over there tomorrow and pick her up and bring her back. And if I went to jail for it, I would. I want them to do the right thing, get the planes over there and bring these people home sooner than later. It is wrong, it's immoral, and it's a sin.
What is your assessment, David, of where the Australian government is on this situation? Are they working behind the scenes and just not telling anyone, or are they trying to make up their mind about what to do? What do you think is going to happen?
I think they're trying to work out what to do. Look, I mean, I've been told by well-informed people previously that there was very little appetite within the Australian government to do anything about them. I notice while we were still over in Syria, Scott Morrison did say that they were working with the International Committee of the Red Cross to sort of get these kids into a position where they could, you know, arrange for them to come home. Now, it's not clear whether that is whether that is a health and medical work that is being done just so that they are in a fit state to come home, or whether the ICRC is actually sort of facilitating on the political front to arrange for them to be flown home. That at this stage is not clear to me. That's something that I think we'll need to explore over the coming days. I think that with an election campaign looming, I do hope that this gets a sensible discussion around it. There is obviously a lot of, there's some sensitive politics here. There is a vulnerability for the politics to be exploited, for fear to be stoked about it. And I really hope that that is not the case. I do hope that both of the major parties can have a sensible discussion about this, because they really need to do that. There are certainly glimmers of optimism that the government is readying to do something about the children in particular. I don't think there is much of a prospect for adults who made informed decisions to go there. That includes women, you know, who, let's face it, may have been in sort of controlling relationships with the men that they were with, and you know, may not have been entirely free to make their own decisions to go there. But look, there are gradations of responsibility there that the government is going to have to find some way to work through on a sort of individual case by case basis. I just don't know whether that's going to happen in the case of adults. When it comes to the men, yeah, look, I don't think there's much appetite at all for bringing them home. I would add one factor. Irrespective of the lack of sympathy that we might have for people like Mohammed Noor Masri, who went there to join IS as a young man, there is also a question of Australia's international responsibility. The Kurds have enough problems. They've got Turkey on one side. They've got the Assad regime on the other, both of whom are threatening them. They are trying to run a reasonably well-functioning, semi-autonomous government there. The last thing they need is thousands of IS fighters that they have to sort of manage in prisons and detention centres. Equally, countries in the region, they don't want a spillover of former ISIS fighters moving into their territory. There is a real, I think, international responsibility on Australia, but also countries in Europe, because they have hundreds. I mean, we're in the low dozens probably, but France, Britain, Germany, Belgium, countries like this have hundreds of people that they are responsible for. And, there is a compelling argument out there that those countries should take responsibility for their own citizens.
Well, David, Kate, well done on your amazing reporting. I'm very pleased to have you both home. And I would make the point to our listeners that there are very few media outlets that would make the kind of investment to send talented reporters and photographers like you into situations like this. And the only reason we can is because people subscribe. So listeners, if you want to support this kind of journalism, subscribe to the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age, and we can keep doing
it. Amen.
Thanks for your time, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tori.
You can read and watch David and Kate's reports from inside Syria in the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. The link to their articles are in our show notes. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said Australia is willing to allow some of the orphaned children of Australian terrorist fighters to return to Australia. Getting them out of Syria will be a feat on its own, but it's only half the story. What happens once they're back on our shores? Dr. Clark Jones is a criminologist based at the Research School of Psychology at the Australian National University. Clark, thanks very much for joining me on Please Explain. Can you just give our listeners an idea of your interest and expertise in this area of de-radicalisation?
I work in two specific areas. One is with prisons, particularly in the Philippines. I work with, have done a lot of ethnographic work, working with offenders in the Philippines. So that's those affiliated with the Maute group, the Islamic State-inspired group in the Philippines, Jamaa Islamiya, Abu Sayyaf, MILF, so a range of terrorist groups in the Philippines. But I also take invested interest in other terrorist offenders and other prison systems such as Australia. And I've just released a book called Inmate Radicalisation and Recruitment in Prisons with Routledge. The other area of my research is I work very closely with Muslim community groups in Melbourne and Sydney with the intent of developing intervention programs to support young kids and families, whether that be through crisis support or more intensive individualised interventions. So I work with a range of community groups, everything from, if I can use the term conservative groups, to those that are more umbrella-type organisations that work with a whole range of different community groups.
These children that we've been reporting on in the last 2 weeks in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, they've got the double whammy. They're in a dire situation in this camp in northern Syria. It's, you know, terrible living conditions. They must be very traumatised. But the other complicating factor for them is that sources on the ground told us that from a very young age, some of these kids would have been indoctrinated into the Islamic State way of thinking and could be very hard to rehabilitate, but the best place to rehabilitate them is here in Australia. Can you tell us what kind of psychological effects these little kids would expect to see in them if and when they get home to Australia?
I think the first thing we want to be careful of is that we don't automatically assume at a young age that a person is so-called radicalised. I think the things that they really need to be addressed first off is if they were to bring them back to Australia under certain conditions would be trauma. I think the kids would have experienced lots of hostile, been in a lot of hostile environments and experienced a lot of violence and possible sort of brutal action, violent action. So trauma would be one thing. We'd looked at post-trauma type situations. But we really want to be trying to get them into a normal environment as possible. And I think I would caution bring them up, back and put them under, you know, police custody or under surveillance or in the sort of security regime that I think a lot of people would like to see them in. But there are, it really depends on the age of the child as well. And there would be, there's a certain kids under five, for example, would need to be treated in a different way than, say, kids between five and, say, 12. And it varies. The older they get, obviously, the more we'd have to start to look at them, that they are not a security risk. But certainly with infants, young people, to say that they're radicalised and a danger to the community, I think is it's wrong. It's not correct.
So are we set up? Do we have the resources in place and the support networks in place that if these children were brought home to Australia, there would be a network around them to deal with their particular set of circumstances?
Look, certainly. There's support networks in a number of ways. I mean, there's certainly the communities that I work with, there are all sorts of programs and support structures and networks that work very effectively, that provide that work with young people for a whole range of situations, from those that have left home to those that have mental health issues, suffering depression or whatever it might be. So there's the community support networks, but you've also got to remember that the government has spent millions of dollars in countering violent extremism programs. Now, I'm not a big fan of those, but however, there are programs run by the police and by government that I think are obviously, for those that are more concerned, would be well suited to those types of programs. We've also got de-radicalisation programs in the correctional systems for those that have broken or proven to have broken the law, that have gone through, that will go through the criminal justice system. Then there are a couple of programs, one in Victoria and one in New South Wales, that have had, you know, mixed results, but certainly working with some well qualified, excellent practitioners that would be able to support these types of people if they were in the criminal justice system.
So what would it look like for, say, a 4 or 5 year old who has possibly even been born in Syria to Australian parents, is brought here? Do they go to school up the road, or do they have to go, do they have to have a special type of education? What does their life look like when they get back here, if we're going to do it properly?
I think the first thing would be to bring them out of that type of, or an environment that I imagine was quite hostile. And I certainly, in my time, have spent time in quite hostile locations. So bring them back to normal, getting them involved in a support network, getting them comfortable. Dealing with any mental health issues would be the first primary concern. Then I think getting them into education would be, it's not a straightforward process, but I think the schools are well equipped for dealing with people of different backgrounds from different experiences. And there's different sort of stages, levels of education. I'm not a teacher, I'm a criminologist, but I have a lot of confidence in the educational system in all states of Australia. But certainly here in the ACT, it's a very, very good school system. So I think there are programs in places for young kids from a preschool age up that can handle these sorts of kids. And certainly from our research, we found that, you know, school connectedness, getting kids involved in and belonging to schools is a really probably the number one protective factor that can support kids, and then family and then community. So education would be a good move to start with.
Managing that in the community would be a particular challenge, though, wouldn't it? I could imagine that if you found out that some of these kids were going to the local primary school with your kids, some of those parents are going to, there's going to need to be a lot of communication and education of the parents at the school, aren't there?
Oh, look, certainly. Yeah, we've got to acknowledge that some of these kids have come from parents that have been involved in terrorism. So, yeah, look, I can imagine concerns by parents, but schools deal with a whole range of problematic behaviour with kids. So there are kids that have parents in prison, in criminal justice system, and they cope quite well within reason. So I can't see why we can't extend it, why we can't be a little bit more compassionate and try and help these kids. These kids do not have a choice in their situation overseas. They were brought over there by their parents. So we need to have a little bit of compassion, a little bit of sympathy, and try and support these kids in this situation. Mm.
I think that's a broadly held view about the children. I wonder what your prognosis is for recovery for these kids. I mean, is it possible to take a child who's been through what sounds to me like hell on earth and deliver them into a relatively normal adolescence?
Certainly. I mean, if I can use the expression that it's hard to teach old dogs new tricks. In other words, kids still got a chance of becoming healthy and productive citizens, and I think the earlier the age and the quicker we bring them back, the better chances they will have. But one thing I haven't mentioned, obviously there'll be health issues, not just mental health issues, but physical health that they will have to also be supported in. But if when we start to talk 15, 16, 17, they've experienced trauma in a different way. They've experienced violence in a different way, and they might be more affected. And I think putting them in a normal school environment may be problematic to start with, and we don't know what their educational background would have been. So, you know, as I said, the older they get, the harder it's going to be to bring them back into a normal environment.
But you think you think we're set up to be able to cope with that?
Oh, look, certainly. And if someone is, well, even juvenile, but over the age of 18 and they're proven to have broken the law, well, they need to face the criminal justice system like anyone else does. But, yes, Australia is well geared in countering terrorism, countering violent extremism. There are all sorts of agencies working on these. If some of those older children need to be put under surveillance or watched carefully, well, so be it.
Well, Dr. Clark Jones, thank you so much for your time. It's very interesting.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to our guests this week, David Rowe, Kate Geraghty and Dr. Clark Jones. Remember, the links to our in-depth reports into the Australians of the Islamic State are in this episode's description. If you're a Please Explain fan, we'd love you to tell others about the podcast and leave a review on iTunes. It's one of the best ways for new listeners to find us online. And of course, you can get in touch with the team. Find the Please Explain email address in our show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. The best way to support the work we do is by taking out a subscription. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age to get yourself started. Unlock a heap of subscriber benefits like unlimited web access on multiple devices, weekend paper deliveries, and special events and discounts. This episode was produced and edited by Rachel Dexter. Field recording by Debbie Harrington. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Special thanks as always to Amelia Maguire, who does all of our production logistics, and to Tom McKendrick, our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.